Our collective nightmare, Amanda Seyfried, is billed as a forgotten female prophet in a movie that is itself an act of mild rebellion against a culture that forgets women, and then sells their absence back to us as art. The Testament of Anne Lee tells the story of a woman who crossed an ocean in 1774, built a communal religion that preached equality and celibacy, and convinced thousands she was the Second Coming. Now the Shakers' number 3 registered members in the whole country. One joined this summer. History is a clearance sale of saints. The film stages a simple scandal. Two young Shakers skip out to an outhouse and break the one rule that binds the sect. The leader expels them without spectacle. No flogging, no tantrum. A light administrative cruelty instead of a theatrical purge. The director treated leadership as a question of ego and restraint, and then made a period musical. About it, that combination was supposed to be unmakeable. A biopic, a musical, a period piece. Hollywood likes easier sins. Mona Fastfold found the story and built a small army to tell it. 300 people who ate indie financing like boiled cabbage and kept working while studios made the same old male cult movies over and over. The set became a tiny commune. The director was called Mother Mona. The industry calls women's stories challenging. Audiences call them niche. The result is a strange, earnest thing. A film about renouncing sex made by people who refuse to renounce the work of making films. Amanda Seyfried agreed to live inside the movie's particular grim hollow. Singing live, screaming, moving like someone possessed, carrying an 18th century Mancunian accent she barely knew. She played a woman who lied about reading and who demanded celibacy while having been married and having lost children to repeated stillbirths. Trauma-shaped doctrine. Doctrine shaped a community. The community dwindled. The myth survived long enough to become a film. This is not a story about predator cults, which Hollywood keeps recycling with appetite and taste for spectacle. It is about a woman who tried to design a safe, austere space and failed at being simple even in her intentions. The film asks us to be in dialogue with her ideas, to consider a leader who leads without theatrics. America's attention span has other plans. We prefer loud villains and easy villains and franchise calendars. The Testament of Anne Lee arrives on Christmas in the United States, like a carol for the exhausted, a musical about going without. It asks nothing from the country that made it, except to look briefly at one odd life before moving on to the next trend. We will probably do that.
Christmas Eve in Cabot, Arkansas. Someone stopped at a Murphy USA, bought a slip of paper, and walked away $1.817 billion richer. That's not a holiday miracle. That's capitalism's idea of last-minute gift wrapping. Last-minute ticket sales pushed it over the top. Families argue over stuffing stockings. Americans argue over which six numbers will rearrange their lives. Nothing says faith in the future like spending a few dollars on statistical improbability between the ham and the cranberry sauce. The prize headline is $1.817 billion. The cash option is $834.9 million. Most people will take the lump sum because nothing screams fiscal responsibility like instant gratification with a side of itemized tax forms. You win the lottery, then you hire 12 people to explain why you should give half away. The annuity option pays you for 30 years, increasing by 5% annually. It's the government's version of "we'll text you later." Prefer the lump sum, the thinking goes, because annuities sound like commitment. Also because rich people never wanted to be on a payment plan. Eight other folks walked out with a million each, 114 won $50,000, 31 won $100,000. That means hundreds of strangers now have to decide whether to stop working, buy a boat, or tell everyone they're only a little bit different now. This was the 47th drawing of the run, a record for "we'll tempt you until you break." The jackpot resets to $20 million for the next draw, which is adorable. That's like the ocean shrinking to a bathtub after a tsunami and everyone clapping. Here's the real first world wrinkle. You win enough to solve every problem except the ones where advice is free and friends are suddenly financial planners. Do you take the money, move to an island, or spend 3 months deciding which charities will get your name engraved on a brick? The point is, we live in a country where the most relatable holiday drama is whether your aunt forgot your name and whether anyone matched five numbers. Somewhere between the gas pump and the kitchen table, our national dream is still a receipt that says "winner" in tiny print.
Christmas dinner turned into a conference call about the future of a country, while that country's lights were being blown out by incoming missiles. Ukraine's president spent the holiday trading polite optimism with Jared Kushner in a Trump envoy. and everyone agreed the next step was more meetings, more ideas, and urgent attention to a plan that asks one side to withdraw and the other to decide what withdrawal will mean in practice. The 20-point blueprint on the table sounds technocratic. Troop movements, security guarantees, a demilitarized seam traced along front lines. In practice, it smells like a map being negotiated under fire. Kyiv is being asked to pull back from parts of Donetsk. Moscow's response has been the usual mix of analysis and maximalist conditions, insisting the region be handed over entirely, while missiles keep making sure the timetable remains. Flexible. The White House, led by a re-elected president who promises an end to war soon, is pushing the middle path. Broker a deal, keep influence, avoid having to deploy more boots. The peace team includes family and friends, holiday cheer, and phrases like constructive and productive. It's the managerial language of compromise, as explosions punctuate the conference agenda. On the ground, nothing has paused. Cities like Odessa suffer power outages and shattered port infrastructure. Towns are still being abandoned as Russian forces push and Ukrainian troops pull back. Kyiv's countermeasures, drones, sabotage, strikes on occupied airfields, answer destruction with more destruction. A Russian general dies in a Moscow car bombing, and everyone updates their assumptions accordingly. Religious leaders appeal for an end to violence while governments argue about who's responsible for prolonging it. Blame becomes its own weapon, the EU accused of escalating, Moscow talking about liberation, Kyiv warning of holiday strikes. The moral clarity of the appeals matters less than the optics of them. Prayer cards handed out between ordnance reports, the language of peace, has become a kind of accounting trick. Security guarantees is a phrase meant to sound solid while leaving the ledger open. What guarantees, who enforces them, and how many lives are acceptable as collateral for a clause? The most realistic outcome is the one that requires the least inconvenience to the stronger party. There is a surreal routine to this era. Negotiate on holiday weekends, announce new ideas, call things substantive, and hope the headlines will creep toward closure faster than the next barrage. War and diplomacy now move in overlapping loops of polite press releases and blunt violence, each treating the other as an administrative detail. If peace comes, it may arrive as an agreement that rewrites borders, one concession at a time. If it doesn't, the very fact that talks continue in the middle of bombing will be proof that the system still functions, not to protect people, but to manage the costs of violence. Either way, the machinery that runs this outcome is calibrated to accept misery as a variable rather than an emergency. That's progress in the language of our age.
From CNN, original title, Christmas Celebrated in Bethlehem, a morning mass at the Church of the Nativity, crowds on Manger Square. Headlines call it a return to normal. Normal, in this telling, means a square with carols and checkpoints, a sacred site ringed by rubble and settlements, a holiday that fits neatly into a catalog of displacement, demolition, and diplomatic statements. People came to celebrate the birthplace of a figure whose life was supposed to be a promise that things could be different. Meanwhile, back in the West Bank, more than 30,000 people were forced from their homes this year. Homes knocked down over permits and politics. Settler outposts were legalized, new settlements announced, and a soldier who drove a quad bike into a man at prayer was officially under review. The universe apparently has a sense of irony that won't quit. Is it comforting or surreal that ritual persists? Maybe both. There's a clear human talent for keeping tradition alive even as the material conditions that make it meaningful are dismantled day by day. We line up for mass and also line up at checkpoints. We sing about peace in a square next to an expansion plan. We light candles while entire neighborhoods are made into lists for international reports. The practical comforts of ceremony can function as protest, solace, or gentle denial. Which one depends on whether you are wearing a choir robe or a hard hat. But either way, the ceremony continues. Crowds limited by roadblocks, footage reviewed by militaries, statements issued by governments, condemnations released by diplomats, and the world keeps translating grief into words that rarely change outcomes, maybe the strangest human skill is our ability to hold contradictions. We are capable of the most tender devotion and the most administrative cruelty at once. We invent rituals to name meaning and then file the meaning away under logistics and policy. On Christmas in Bethlehem, the nativity scene looks the same while the map keeps changing. That should be beautiful, or tragic, or both. It's probably exactly what we've earned. A hymn with a footnote.
The capitalist fever dream gold has become the fever dream of a civilization that prefers glitter to governance. A 71% surge this year, the kind of leap not seen since an oil-starved, inflation-blinded 1979, is not an accident. It is the market's necropsy report. Investors stampede toward a metal that pays no interest because everything that promised steady returns has been hollowed out. Bonds yield less as central banks loosen. Currencies wobble as geopolitics weaponize balance sheets. And states answer crises by seizing assets and rerouting trade. When tariffs contort commerce and war redraw credit lines, a rock becomes a currency of last recourse. Nations that once trusted treasury bonds now hoard bullion by the ton. China leads the scramble not for romance but for immunization against frozen reserves and policymaker hostage taking. Central banks buying over 1,000 tons a year, double the decade's norm, reads less like strategy and more like panic in institutional clothing. The sanctity of paper promises has been breached. The response is to stack metal like sandbags. The spectacle is predictably grotesque. Precious metals across the board have exploded. Silver up 146%, platinum nearly 150%, palladium 100%, turning fear into a commodities carnival. Retail theater joins state hoarding, jewelry sales spike, Costco sells gold bars, and every mall counter becomes an altar to scarcity. Analysts project $5,000 an ounce in a few years, and that projection self-fulfills by advertising the future shortage it helps create. Prices rise partly because less bullion circulates. Less bullion circulates because institutions and speculators treat it like survival rations. This is capitalism's dark choreography. Policy that corrodes yields, geopolitics that corrodes trust, and markets that convert both into profit. The Fed's interest rate flirting makes non-yielding gold more seductive. Deficits and debt burdens do the rest, persuading investors to prefer inert metal over faltering promises. Each new headline, a seized tanker, a frozen reserve, a tariff spike, is fertilizer for the next surge. Profit is being made on the mechanics of collapse. Jewelers cash in on desperation. ETFs package dread into retail-friendly shares. Central banks cloak geopolitical realignment as portfolio diversification. The result is a global economy increasingly organized around hoarding rather than production, around vaults rather than infrastructure. The more fragile the system, the shinier the refuge. The shinier the refuge, the more fragile the system becomes. Every ounce bought is a vote of no confidence in the paper world. The market's golden. Fever is not an investment trend. It is an emission of institutional cowardice and the commodification of fear. In the end, wealth is concentrated not by creating value, but by cornering the means to survive the collapse one's own policies help produce.